It's lights out and away we go.
What a match day this was.
I will try not to breathe. I can hold my head still with my hands and my knees. These eyes are the eyes of the old, shivering and bold. I will try not to breathe. This decision is mine. I have lived a full life. These are the eyes that I want you to remember.
Podcasting from Studio 2520, somewhere near Akron, Ohio, and live via the paid subscription of Zencast through the campus of Otterbein University. This is Tackling the Chicane.
I can hold these inside. I will hold my breath until all these shivers subside. Just look in my eyes. I will try not to worry. I have seen things that you will.
REM.
Leave it to memory.
So a very instrumental band for me in my high school years. Cannot believe that document number 5 is nearly 40 years old. And REM's debut album, released in 1983, makes it 41 years old. So setting myself out there in time. If you're not familiar, please get familiar. The discography is very deep. Basically, we've got Michael Stipe, lead singer, Peter Buck, guitarist, Mike Mills on bass, and Bill Berry. And for that pre-90s alternative era, it did not get much better than this particular group.
Mm-mm. And that cut there from Automatic for the People, 1998. Two release, I think.
8th studio effort, one of my all-time favorite tracks. And if you dig into this band's catalog, I guarantee you will find one of the non-Billboard top 40 hits that you will fall in love with.
Yeah, that album in particular, for me, is one of my favorites in the No Skips. That is what I would classify as a no skip album for me.
Yeah, most of their albums were sort of storyous in the way that if you listen from track 1 to track end, just great stuff. So if you're out there, REM, we could use a little little sponsorship.
We'll pedal.
We could get busted for playing your songs. I don't know.
Yeah. All right. Well, this is going to be an interesting one, to say the least. So about 24 hours ago, I was, in preparation for this show thinking, Jurgen Klopp leaving Liverpool FC would be the biggest story we'd talk about. And, of course, that's a big story in it of itself, obviously. But this past week has been kind of just full of shocking surprises that we've been waking up to. And it started with the Klopp thing. And now let's just do it. Lewis Hamilton will be driving for Ferrari.
Yeah. This took me quite by surprise, and I did not hear any underpinnings of this happening. I got a text a push update on my phone, and I had to look twice and click on the article. I thought maybe it was a clickbait thing at first. This morning, And then, of course, our inner circle, fellas, we kind of went back and forth a bit and said, this sounds a little irrational. We think maybe one of the motorsport magazines is trying to, you know, get a little press, or as a lot of times that shows up in your feed and it's a non-story.
Mm-hmm.
And then just four to six short hours later, it was pretty much a sealed deal that Lewis Hamilton will vacate his seat on the Mercedes team and go to Ferrari. Those of you in the know will have many of the same questions that we do. If you're an outsider to F1, what this does is basically sets a domino effect in motion.
Yeah.
Because now we have a vacant seat in a very competitive Mercedes car. We have a supplanted Ferrari driver, of which both of them had a quite good performance last season.
Mm-hmm.
Who will be shuffled from Ferrari? Where will that person end up? And, you know, okay, so what is going to be the end result of this one driver shift from Mercedes to Ferrari? And who fills in all of the possibilities in the background? And I'm sure that being a few weeks out from race number one in the 2024 season, this is going to be a very populated discussion for the next several days here.
Yeah. So I guess a couple basic things to know about this whole thing. Lewis Hamilton will be competing for Mercedes in the 2024 season. So this is not like he's up and left today. So yeah, this is for 2025. And at this moment, we also know that it's going to be Carlos Sainz that is getting the boot, essentially. Just last week, Charles Leclerc inked a new deal with Ferrari that, in classic F1 fashion, all they said was past 2024, so past this year.
So I think what it's going to bring to the series, even though this is a series out, is there'll be some, at least in my opinion, you know, this is going to float around throughout the 2024 campaign.
Yeah.
And I think as we move through the campaign, obviously there's going to be other announcements of shuttling from here to there. That's just the way that it's going to unfold, which will make it most watchable,
at least in
my opinion. And then you also have to think, okay, what kind of impact does this have performance-wise? We'd like to think that he's going to sit in the car and do whatever he has to do to bring Mercedes, you know, maybe even more success than they had in the 2023 campaign.
Mm-hmm.
But that remains to be seen. And when the shuffling starts happening, and it could go as far down as some of the lower ranking teams.
Oh yeah, without a doubt. I want to spend some time, sort of some serious time on the shuffling thing. But I kind of want to keep it Lewis centric for the beginning here, just to keep a little bit of structure, because I will go down the reshuffle rabbit hole for sure.
I think it's kind of important to quickly recap where we landed at the end of last year driver standings. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Verstappen, Red Bull number one, Perez, Red Bull number two, Lewis Hamilton, Mercedes number three, Fernando Alonso number four, Leclerc 5, Lando Norris 6, Carlos Sainz number 7, Ferrari driver, Number 8, George Russell for Mercedes, Piastri for McLaren, Lance Stroll, number 10, Aston Martin. So that rounds out your top 10. And then constructor standing-wise, just to put a little flavor into the mix, of course, Red Bull dominates. Mercedes, with a very strong campaign in 2023, ends up number 2 in the constructor standings, albeit only 3 points ahead of Ferrari at 406 points, with Mercedes clocking in at 409. So when I first heard the rumblings before it was made official this morning, my take was, well, you finished ahead of Ferrari as a constructor. In what planet would you want to put your ass in the seat of a Ferrari? But as we also know that, you know, money talks a lot in this series. And, you know, maybe Lewis was not super thrilled with some of the things that had happened in the 2022 season. This is a kind of a side note, but I went back earlier this week out of sheer boredom in the evening and started replaying the Drive to Survive season, which basically is clocked at 2022. And I had forgotten just kind of the disaster that Mercedes was with their car just, you know, a short season ago.
Yeah. I think here's the question that is circulating this around this move. First off, I will say, in, you know, every single driver on the grid, whether they'll want to admit it or not, if Ferrari comes knocking at what at some point in their career, even if it's not tomorrow, it is incredibly hard as a race car driver to say no to Ferrari. That is just the way it is. That is, you know, that it's, if you're a baseball player and the Yankees say, we want you to play for us, it's like, how do you say no to that? So I think that's important. And then one other thing here, Lewis is obviously not stupid. So, and we know the development of a season's car is not something that they just, you know, a season ends and then they go, okay, time to start developing the next car. That is happening throughout the season for the next one. Was there something that Lewis saw for this upcoming season that made him say, there is just no way I can win another championship with Mercedes with the time I have left in my career?
I think that's it's a perfect observation. And I think these guys are wired to win. And this has been kind of a really challenge, you know, as good as Lewis is at putting on the happy face. And he's one of my favorite drivers because he feels really genuine. You know, he's always supported the fan base. He's the first guy to really give props to the people who come out, spend their hard earned money to go to these races and to show up. But at the end of the day, if you don't think that he wants to get at that top seat again, that is the goal. So apparently this is, he feels pretty strongly about that. Because, I mean, his legacy is Mercedes.
Yeah.
We were kind of texting back and forth even just a few minutes ago, and one of probably the most knowledgeable fellows that we hang with, Mr. Jimmy Hill, who really has a propensity to dissect things at a much higher level than we do. He's been more in tune with the series for longer than probably anybody I know. brought up a pretty good point. And he said, you know, historically, this is not new news as far as drivers just basically grasshoppering or jumping from team to team. Mm-hmm. And sometimes back in the day, they would do it during a campaign.
Yeah.
I would shuffle from seat to seat.
Mm-hmm.
We, as younger F1 fans, and just, you know, honestly, maybe 2 years into really keeping a keen eye on the series, we're kind of used to the team is the team and the status quo, mm-hmm. unless, you know, there's some kind of a fail point, you know, somewhere. But
yeah,
this really interlaces with what's coming in the 26-ish campaign, where we're going to possibly see some major redesign of all the cars. And it just kind of makes it, I'm all in. Today I was like, oh, this will kind of roll into the next 2 years.
Absolutely. You know,
as far as making this, you know, something to watch.
I mean, if you don't think the story of Lewis Hamilton moving to Ferrari is not going to be this massive fucking storm cloud that hangs around the garage all year, you are sorely mistaken. I mean, this is going to be talked about every single race because
probably ad nauseum.
Yeah, and we're going to have to get used to that. But again, you mentioned it at the beginning of this. This is not just Lewis Hamilton moving to Ferrari. This is Lewis Hamilton kicks Carlos Sainz out of a seat, and now there's a Mercedes seat open. Young guys want it. Teams are going to be shuffled around. I mean, this is a huge move for the series. And
so, go ahead.
I was just going to say, it's like, remember when LeBron went to the Lakers? It's like that, but times 10. Like, it's hard to wrap your head around what Lewis Hamilton moving to Ferrari is like.
Well, there's a couple of things that come up. Firstly, regardless of success or failure, Ferrari is the number one grossing team in F1 as far as fan support goes. All you have to do is watch any race and it's a sea of red, doesn't matter what it is. Okay. So that's huge. But what will be the gain or loss of teams that are maybe lower on the table? Will they be able to collect a driver from an unseated higher team and bring them into the fold? Mm-hmm. And Aston Martin, I don't think McLaren is going to make any major moves, but anything is on the table at this point.
Yeah.
You know, and I could see an unseated guy, you know, take an offer from an Aston, or I won't go as far as Williams. I think they might be too far down on the table, but
yeah.
You know, in fantasy land.
Well, here's the thing though. Williams, obviously very, very, very close relationship with the Mercedes team. Obviously, Mercedes come 2025 is going to have a seat open. There's a pretty damn good young driver that drives for Williams named Alex Albon. You know, like that's the thing.
The Elevate.
You have to see how this season goes, but based off of what we saw from him last year, if he builds off of that, maybe he does get a call from Mercedes, and obviously he's not turning. There's no way he's turning that down.
So I think that it makes this a much a must watch campaign coming up here in 2024, because everyone's performance is going to be very much on the grading table, because everybody's going to be looking for moves.
Yeah.
How do you qualify? How do you look for the race? Where do you finish? You know, what is the driver impact on a team versus maybe a mechanical failure impact, right? So if we see some of the lower table guys make really great performances, I think they're going to be on the watch list for a move.
Yeah. Okay. So before we really get into the weeds, because I do kind of want to get into the speculation of who goes where, I'm just going to ask it. Do you think Lewis Hamilton can win a championship with Ferrari?
The short answer to that question is no.
Okay.
But can he propel the Ferrari team to a very close race with Red Bull? Possibly.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. It all remains to be seen, right? And I can't predict the future. I can't predict how Red Bull is going to navigate this particular upcoming season. It's just going to be, like I said, it's going to be one to watch, and I think it's going to develop as the campaign kind of unfolds this year.
Okay, yeah, I agree. I would honestly, for just the romance of it, would kind of love this.
Do you think that he can?
Well, yeah, like I was, you know, again, the sort of romantic side of me wants to be like, oh, Lewis Hamilton goes to Ferrari and wins a championship. I mean, incredible stuff. But no, I don't think so. In come 2025, when he moves, I think Charles Leclerc is going to be a better driver than him if he isn't already. We'll see, but I don't know how much of this move for Ferrari is about, we think Lewis Hamilton can win us a world championship, and compared to this move is, we need a guy like Lewis Hamilton to sort of put us back into the number one seat in terms of popularity.
Or in, the good graces of the fandom.
I mean, much respect to Carlos Sainz, but obviously Lewis Hamilton is a much bigger name.
It's kind of like when a quarterback moves from one team to the other in the NFL, like a Tom Brady
going to the
move, or it is all about. And I my conspiracy tinfoil hat theorist kind of entered this afternoon, and I'm thinking, okay, could this potentially be a scripted move by F1 to just sort of shake up the eight ball a little bit, you know? shake up the series. Some interest. Because of the dominance of Red Bull, it's a much different dominance than even the Mercedes dominance was, because now you've got more eyes on the series. You've got more United States eyes on the series.
Not only that, obviously the viewership is up. It's a different dominance because, one, in 2023, Red Bull was untouchable. They lost one race. Now, Mercedes had some very dominant years, but never like that. And Mercedes was dominant in one of the weakest eras of F1 in terms of viewership. Like, many people maybe forget now, pre Drive to Survive, pre COVID, basically, the eyes on the series had never really been lower. And that probably some of that actually came from the dominance of Lewis Hamilton and Mercedes. But whether or not this was a maybe predetermined move by F1, I'm sure they are loving it. I mean, this is exactly the type of news you want to hear if you're the marketing team for F1 right before the new season's about to start. So,
yeah, it's almost, you can't deny the glossiness of a move like this. And now it's going to bring even more attention to the start of this season, even though the moves don't happen for another campaign. I mean, it's just from a single viewership standpoint, it's made me want to tune in.
I mean, how could it not? You have two drivers in Lewis Hamilton and Carlos Sainz who are elite that have this thing just over them the entire season. It's a built-in storyline for every single race. Now, what will be really, really interesting is what happens the first time they meet each other on track. Let's say in a overtaking situation, how that plays out. Yeah. And one thing we haven't talked about, and I haven't seen much discussion about, Carlos Sainz, I follow him on Instagram. He gave a very, my PR agent wrote this message on his Instagram story. Basically, my focus is with Ferrari for this season and that's it. But how long has he known that Lewis Hamilton was joining Ferrari and he lost the seat? I don't know.
You can't get an introspective of that until this will be two seasons out, and maybe this will propel Drive to Survive forward.
Yeah.
Usually after four or five seasons on a Netflix series, everyone's like, okay, well, I've seen enough of that.
Mm-hmm.
We've had a lot of major breaking stories in the last couple of months here with mm-hmm. the Steiner exit at Haas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now we have this, and I'm sure that this is going to breed much more of that kind of meat
mm-hmm.
for the Drive to Survive series.
Yeah.
Who's going where and when. And you know what? To be honest with you, I'm okay with it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't need things to stay stagnant in F1. I'd like to see a little mix up here and there. So
yeah.
And we've got it now.
We did. Big time.
Today was funny because between the push notifications from F1 and sort of our collective banter back and forth, I'm like, well, this could be the biggest thing that's happened, at least in a couple of years that you and I have been following the series.
Oh, without a doubt. In terms of F1 news, this is the mecca of shit we've covered. I mean, you know, we entered at the, maybe not the beginning, but sort of the, honestly, the beginning of the Verstappen true dominance. So the racing product, while it's, you know, it's been fun to cover and interesting, you know, it's hasn't been like the greatest thing ever by any means. But this story, Lewis Hamilton joining Ferrari, it still doesn't even sound real. It sounds like something you do in a video game.
Yeah.
I never, ever would have thought he would race for Ferrari. Really didn't think that.
I don't think most people thought that Lewis Hamilton would end his career, you know, with Mercedes.
Mm-hmm.
But Yeah, I mean, it shifts. It's a completely dynamic shift. I don't want to fast forward through this coming campaign, but, you know, I'm already looking forward to what's going to happen. And some of it will transpire this year. I mean, we're going to get more announcements of seat changes and you know,
it's like you don't think Carlos Sainz is going all of 2024 not knowing what team he's racing for in 2025. That'll break sometime this year during the season, I would imagine. And I had mentioned it, but if you're Sergio Perez, you're thinking, I got to be lights out. I've got to be lights out this season. Because how the hell, if I'm Red Bull, am I seeing Carlos Sainz, a former Red Bull driver, he raced for Toro Rosso, how are you saying he's available and we are not going to offer him a seat? Because I think, I don't know what you think, I think Carlos Sainz is better than Sergio Perez right now, and I struggle to see why you don't offer him the seat for 2025 over Sergio Perez, unless Sergio Perez is great and Carlos Sainz isn't in 2024.
Well, and I think this is going to write its own, it's going to write its own script depending on finishing order and race performance amongst those two guys. And so diligently as the season progresses, we're going to have to watch that kind of stuff.
Yeah. You know,
who's qualifying better, who's finishing better. And that's what's going to make or break either one of those two particular seats. So yeah, I'm totally looking forward to what's coming up. This was a nice interjection coming into the 2024 season, where we were looking for more of the same, and we may have more of the same, but, as you said, just from a viewer standpoint, this is going to be front and center.
Yeah.
100%. I can't wait to see the first GP because the pre-show is going to be just nothing but
Lewis Ferrari, Lewis Ferrari, Lewis Ferrari. Yeah.
Yeah. Pretty much.
Yeah.
Which I'm okay with.
Yeah. You know what? The series needed a little injection of something. I think we all can agree. So
agreed. I'm happy with that. The foil hat again.
Okay. Yeah. So
ultimately a move that was prodded by Formula One to shake things up, or maybe not. I mean,
I don't know.
I would love to
have. Who cares?
Yeah, who cares? I'd love to have Jimmy on one of the podcasts because I think he could give us a perspective from somebody who's, you know, was around back in the 80s and 90s watching watching F1. So unless you have anything else, I mean, do you have like any brass tack predictions of seat filling or I mean, you mentioned that you think that, you know,
Think Red Bull is going to look different in 2025, honestly. Whether or not that's Carlos Sainz remains to be seen. I kind of feel like that would make sense. Obviously, Mercedes, George Russell is locked. He's, at this point, their golden boy, which is fine. I don't know. I think Albon, like I said, could fill that. There's obviously a whole swath of F2 drivers that could fill that. I don't know. Fernando Alonso is still kind of around and doing well.
Yeah, I think that looking 2 to 3 seasons ahead, that Alonso's probably going to hang it up at some point.
Yeah, but shit, I mean, he hasn't shown any signs of slowing down. Oh. That's the thing. So I don't know. Who knows? He's sort of the ageless wonder of the series.
Sebastian Vettel didn't either.
No. And then he just kind of shut it down himself. Yeah. So I don't know. No idea. Yeah, I think we could probably for now, because obviously this is sort of an ongoing story, but for now, close it down with that.
We can probably get a few minutes. we should talk about the Andretti.
Yeah, I mean, until 12 hours ago, I was leading the show with the Andretti thing, but
so was I.
Here we are.
So was I. This becomes a
somehow
second tier story.
Exactly.
Basically, what it comes down to is their application for joining the series has been rejected yet again. But I think it's important to understand the monetary investment that Andretti has put forth to create an F1 team has not gone away. And we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars in development. They have a car in the wind tunnel as we speak.
Mm-hmm.
And they will continue to kind of develop under the table a car that at some point will inevitably, I think, will be an F1, an F1 offering. There's been a lot of articles written on how, and I have to agree to some point. F1 can be kind of, they can be assholes, basically. Mm-hmm. But there was a quote by the FIA that said that research indicates that F1 would bring value to the Andretti brand rather than it being the other way around. So basically, they're saying, well, you need us.
Mm-hmm.
We don't need you. I have to disagree wholeheartedly. I think we definitely need another American-based team. The United States has backed this series for the last 4 years. People have come out. We have 3 GPs in the U.S. now. We deserve another U.S. offering.
Well, I'll say you deserve a real U.S. offering. Now, I appreciate what Gene Haas has done, but not exactly a true American team, you know. What Andretti was offering was obviously the Andretti name, which is the most legendary American racing name ever, and a GM works team. So they had the Cadillac backing. They were going to be a Renault customer team for 2 or 3 years, and then their plan was to have a GM power unit. Now, F1... basically told them to go blow. Like they pulled some shit where they were like, we expect them to be a GM works team immediately. And we need them to prove their value, basically. And we don't expect them to be competitive enough. Oh my God.
Yet you allowed Haas to come in and ride the coattails of Ferrari. And there was a lot of articles around the fact that when Gunther Steiner left Haas, he basically said, look, they've hung their hat too high they're asking too much of Ferrari, which is never, I mean, just think about it. Ferrari's not going to up bolster a U.S. team. Mm-mm. Over their own team.
No.
it what it comes down to is, here's the power unit. Good luck.
Mm-hmm.
And I know there's a lot of Ferrari based technology. I'm sure that Haas has a lot of, they have a place in Italy, for Christ's sakes.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, we all know that they're going to protect their main brand, you know.
What I don't really like from the statement that was released by the F1 was the sort of standoffishness. First off, Andretti was 100,000% willing to pay the $200 million fee to get a team in F1. He did not ask to be babied by F1 to allow them to try to be competitive. He had a very strategic plan with financial backing, with fucking power unit backing from GM, and he got Cadillac on board. This is not just some, I mean, 10 years ago, all you had to do was be a fucking Indian businessman with a few billion dollars, and suddenly you had a fucking F1 team.
Kingfisher?
Yeah, so what the hell? Well, I know what changed, obviously, the viewership, but how?
No,
stand down, F1, is what I'm saying. You're full of shit.
100% agree. And I feel in my heart the fact remains that he's not going to. He's going to continue to push. They'll have no choice but eventually to let him in. And, you know, it's not really fair. The reasons why why Andretti Autosport has been kept out of this series are 100% complete bullshit. You know, the argument that, well, there's not enough money to be shared amongst the teams, and it even got so badly contested that they said, well, we strictly don't have room for you guys to show up.
Yeah. Oh,
okay. All right.
Spare me.
Yeah.
Spare me that horse shit, please, for the love of God.
That story continues to unfold. I give Andretti Autosport and Michael Andretti many props for perseverance and putting a car in the wind tunnel and spending the money to develop a car. And even though they've been denied, they're going to continue to work on the car. They're going to continue to put forth the effort to come into the series.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't think at some point they're going to have to. They're going to have to.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the only logical, at some point F1 would imagine plateaus in terms of revenue streams, and, you know, obviously it's a the series is healthy enough to, seriously, we can't add an 11th team. And I know it's, well, that's going to put stress on our sponsors who have to pay more, and that's going to put stress on teams who expect a certain amount of money from the prize pot, basically. And I think the weirdest point to me, it was like, okay, so you think the Andretti being an F1 adds more value to them than it does to you. Okay, that's fine. That is kind of right. However, you don't think that fucking Haas adds more value to themselves than F1. You don't think Williams adds more value to themselves. You don't think Alpine, Alfa Romeo, who aren't there anymore, but my point still stands. You have like half the damn grid that adds more value to themselves being in F1 than it's Ferrari, Mercedes, and maybe Red Bull, basically, and McLaren. there's like four teams that if they left red, if they left F1, you'd be like, oh shit, that's not good. Yeah. You know?
And there's been some interesting photographs, speaking of Red Bull, of a car with a Ford based power unit for 2026. So does that mean that Honda is going to shuttle themselves at some point?
Yeah, Honda's in a weird state right now, and I it does seem like Red Bull is, they're going to be Ford basically, or have some sort of a partnership with Ford starting 2026. I think Honda's basically all but out at this point. Honda's, I don't know, they're being wishy-washy on a lot of fronts, because right now in the IndyCar world, they're concerned that Honda will pull out of that series. So I don't know.
Yeah. Remains to be seen.
But sure. The sort of funniest point, and it's only funny in a cynical sense, but it was like in their statement, they're like, now, you know, we just basically shat all over you and said how worthless you were to us, but you can try again in 2028 and maybe then we'll let you in.
Yeah, it breaks my heart to think that it could be another 4 years before we see an opportunity. But things change pretty rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
The only other thing that I'll say before we leave the realm of F1 is when you speak of Cadillac, and a lot of the listeners might equate that to what your 85-year-old grandma liked to drive back and forth in her Coupe de Ville to church. But this is a very serious performance brand from GM right now.
Mm-hmm.
Not just from a streetcar perspective, because they have two vehicles right now that are making a lot of waves in the production car realm, and that's the CTS-V4 and the CTS-V5, which are very popular vehicles. They are pretty much a stalwart in the IMSA series.
Yep.
The 24 Hours of Daytona just ran last weekend, and I was able to watch a fair amount of it.
Yeah, I got to watch some too, actually.
Really fun to watch, but the GTP prototype cars, they're very strong in that. So, yeah, this is a real player. And I hope F1 gives them basically their due. I mean, let's get another team in there that's US-based, and like you said, not just a glom on Ferrari team, which ultimately has been the downfall of Haas, is they've relied too much on that partnership, and the handshake is only good for so long.
Mm-hmm.
Ferrari's only going to share so much with a team like Haas. We saw ballistic things happen to Ferrari power units in the last couple of years for the Haas team.
Yeah.
If we can get a bespoke manufacturer with the US-based power unit, let's go.
Yeah. Not for 2026, I guess.
No.
Unfortunate. But
hope remains alive, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so, yeah, I did get to watch a little bit of that 24-hour at Daytona race. Kind of fun, actually. I think I'll have to keep a little closer eye on IMSA, because there's some cool stuff going on there. And it was also cool just to see some driver overlap, that the Penske team that ended up winning, you know, Joseph Newgarden, obviously a big name, and Colton Herta and Alexander Rossi and Jenson Button, you know, these are guys you hear about, obviously. So it was cool to watch.
And Castro Neves has won multiple Daytona 24-hour races. Now, the particular team that he had raced for in the past did not enter a car this year.
Mm-hmm.
It's an Ohio-based team right down by you.
Yeah, Meyer Shank. Pataskala, baby.
Yeah. For some reason, they sat out this year. I'm not sure.
I don't know.
It could be for a lot of reasons. I mean, this is a pretty expensive effort.
Yeah. And it's not, it doesn't seem like there's much return for it other than we won. Or we raced. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which it is kind of, it's cool to see that they even do it. But yeah, Meyer Shank Racing, Pataskala, Ohio. It's going to be 20 minutes east of where I'm at. Little small town. Have a good friend, Garrett Miller, actually. Shout out to him from Pataskala. They're Honda and IndyCar. I think they are an Acura team, if I'm not mistaken, in IMSA.
Correct.
Yeah, so pretty cool to have a nice, very close connection there. And then one other thing, keep prolonging the motorsports here, but NASCAR, like I mentioned, got the Netflix treatment last week. NASCAR Full Speed, 5 episodes on Netflix. Me and my buddies binged it, and pretty good, I would say. I think worth a watch.
So season 1?
Yeah. So it picks up at the beginning of the playoffs, basically, so it's not the full season, but that's still 10 races worth of stuff, and it follows the playoffs, and it's your classic Netflix sports documentary. You get behind-the-scenes looks at these drivers and probably a little bit of Hollywood here and there, but it was still cool, so.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
any time we can have ancillary distractions to watch as we slog through this off season.
Mm-hmm.
Always good. So
yeah.
Agreed.
Off season basically no longer, because little exhibition race at the LA Coliseum for NASCAR Sunday, the Clash at the Coliseum. It takes the word exhibition in times 10 because it's a tiny ass track, but it's,
yeah, but very something popular, to watch. Very popular amongst the locale there.
Mm-hmm.
So it gives an opportunity for a fan base in Los Angeles who could never go to Michigan or Watkins Glen or whatever have you. And they do a nice job with it. It got good coverage last year. I expect it to be covered as well.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's what we have to watch right now. So yeah. I'll watch it.
Yep. And
it's really cool. The cool factor is they actually lay a bespoke track for this mm-hmm. event.
Yeah, they really do put a lot of money into it. Yeah. Yeah.
So they lay a track for a couple of weeks and then come in and tear it out of there.
So. Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know. If you have nothing else to do Sunday at 8 p.m., then tune in, I guess. Well, 54 minutes spent on motorsports, but.
We knew this unprecedented. Would be a bonus show for the faction. So,
absolutely, absolutely, and we're gonna shift into the world of soccer with more sort of breaking, maybe not breaking at this point, but big news out of the Liverpool Football Club camp, and about as unexpected as the Lewis Hamilton thing. Maybe not with quite the fanfare, but still quite a bit. So this centers around Liverpool's manager since 2015, Jurgen Klopp. basically announcing that he is going to leave the club at the end of the season. To give you some context to this move, when Jurgen Klopp came to Liverpool, they were a pretty much a train wreck. They were in shambles by their standards, just kind of farting around mid-table in the Premier League. They had not won a league title in 25 years. And immediately this was a guy that turned it around, and you could see that his style of play, which had always been sort of pedal to the metal, score tons of goals, wall-to-wall action, was going to turn around the team. But they were always sort of defensively a liability. Well, fast forward a few years, and they spend a lot of money on defenders, and they get very, very good. They were involved in 2018-19 season in probably the greatest Premier League title race ever, which came down to the last day, where they were 1 point short of Manchester City. The teams finished on 98 points and 97 points, respectively. However, that campaign, they won the European Cup, which is basically the Super Bowl of soccer outside of the World Cup. And the year after, won the Premier League. So Jurgen Klopp delivered the club's first league title since 1990. And since then, they've always been competitive. Obviously, they are top of the league right now. And he's won a couple more trophies as well, an FA Cup and League Cup. They're in the League Cup final here in a few days. So this was a pretty shocking move when he decided, while his team was top of the Premier League, that he was done.
And is he finished as a manager, or do you see him maybe?
Yeah, that's where things
showing up at some point here.
So somewhere. he's not old by managerial standards. He's 56 years old, and I don't expect this to be it for him. I think, he'll take a break, a sabbatical or whatever, and probably move on. He's German. There's always the question of, does he take over the German national team? At this moment in time, it doesn't seem likely to happen, as the German national team just hired their new manager, Julian Nagelsmann, who's very young, like 35, not too long ago. So that, I don't think that job is necessarily in danger anytime soon. So I would be shocked if it's his last job in football altogether, but it does seem like he will be taking an extended period of time off.
Fair enough. Not sure. Do you want to dive into the Liverpool Chelsea match, or?
Yeah, we can dive into it, because again, sort of timely here, just because this actually happened last night. I'm at this amazing part of my track season where we go to these meets and they last all day, and then I don't really get to watch as much soccer as I want or as I'd prefer, even though it's still more than plenty. But it was nice to have some midweek coverage for this one. So yeah, we can dive into it a little bit here. I thought, a very entertaining match for sure. Chelsea, and I'm sure you saw as you watched, not very good, are they? Not very good this year.
No, but you know what I felt from the very beginning, and I had the opportunity to catch this one live. Took a short lunch break. But could the announced staff be more excited about Liverpool?
Chelsea
really kind of, I felt like they played kind of a scrappy defense. I don't know. It's probably the fact that you're way better at the nuts and bolts of the game.
Well, I didn't see the
failure that they kept through the first half, especially. They kept every single Liverpool possession, the timber was raised.
Mm-hmm.
They were so excited.
Yeah. No, I know what you mean, because that's always been the case with Liverpool. I think it's just, it seems to be a club that everyone just seems to love, to put it nicely.
Like the darlings of.
Yes. I mean, with Anfield, it's obviously a fantastic stadium. It's storied. They have a great fan base. But it's like you tune into a game and they start Anfield, the pantheon of soccer, and listen to the crowd, and you're like, okay, yeah, it's great, but I'll be a little coarse here. The Premier League loves to kind of jerk themselves off, if I can be completely honest. So if you watch, and maybe, you know, I don't know, we'll have to do it sometime. Watch an Italian league game, watch a German league game, hell, watch even some Scottish league games, whatever. The atmosphere in the stadiums are way fucking better. Way better. Like,
yeah.
It's okay, yeah, Anfield's loud, but it's loud when Liverpool's good, and then it's a fucking library.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So that applies to all the Premier League, though.
When a certain play in the second half, it's way down on my table of notes, was described as a delicious pass. That's when I pen down. Okay, I'm over your zealousness for this particular club.
Yeah, and again, announcers obviously are paid to sort of hype things up.
And yeah, even in the second half, when Chelsea had no chance of winning this game, I felt like they stayed in the game. I just wanted a little bit more. Hey, this is a great effort by them, instead of this is piss poor.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And from the perspective of the broadcast booth, you had Graham Lasso, who was. He was the color guy, basically the expert analyst. He played for Chelsea, so I think he was probably a little overly critical of their performance. Now, it's no secret that the defense was pretty shocking at times. I honestly think this was more a case of, first off, Chelsea are a super, super young team that are, if you go on to FotMob and click on the game and go to lineup, you will see 10 players that were hurt for Chelsea. So this was a team that by no means was full strength. And Liverpool have, for my money, the best attack in the Premier League at the moment, which was very evident right from the rip, basically. You know, in the 8th minute, Darwin Nunez, who... he's an interesting player, to say the least.
He likes to take shots from what I consider way out.
Yeah, and they don't really usually work. He was getting pretty damn close, and my friend Cody, who is a huge Liverpool fan, he told me today that I didn't hear the stat, but Darwin Nunez set a Premier League record for most times a shot hit the woodwork in a game with 4. So he hit the post 4 times, including that missed penalty right before the end of the first half. Yeah. He just has a knack for getting in really good positions and then just totally fucking up the finish, basically.
I wouldn't say not accurate because we're talking about inches.
Yeah.
When they're, you know, busting off the post or the top rail,
mm-hmm.
Versus, you know, kicking into the seats.
Yeah.
But yeah, so 23rd minute, finally, Diego Jota. We've got the first points on the board there.
Mm-hmm. That was
check for an arm ball, which ended up not being an arm ball.
No, that was clearly off his chest. For me, that was probably the most preposterous play in terms of a Chelsea defensive perspective, just because all Jota did was just kind of force his way through the two players, and they just kind of were bullied off the ball, and he made it 1-0. But yeah, I don't know if this was a super disastrous Chelsea performance as more of it was, I think Liverpool was just on a different level in this particular one. 34th minute, ball taken off the Chelsea midfielder, Luis Diaz releases Bradley. Now, this was a guy that I didn't even really know about because...
Boy, they love him.
Yeah, so this is a...
My God.
This is a young kid that was basically going to be sent on loan because he didn't have a place in the squad until Trent Alexander-Arnold, their right back for Liverpool, got injured. Connor Bradley, he's 20 years old, Northern Irish. To give him credit, he did play lights out. He did play lights out, but...
Yeah.
A great finish here, and VAR, another VAR check, gives them the goal. And I think, again, this is where you can kind of run into the situation of the announcers maybe a little excited.
I also felt like a lot of yellows were dealt to Chelsea on potentially questionable tackles mm-hmm. and or fouls.
The penalty that was awarded, if you are watching in real speed and not slowing it down and zooming in, it's not the most egregious thing you're ever going to see. I mean, it was a stamp on the foot, which it's a foul. I get why it's a penalty. It's just like, how bad was Chelsea's performance here compared to just Liverpool were just suffocating them, essentially.
Right. Yeah, so that PK goes off the right post by not inches but centimeters, and had the ball taken a left trajectory versus a right trajectory, we would have had another goal.
Uh-huh.
But it was not Petrovic needs some props. He
agreed.
He made some really great saves in this game.
Mm-hmm.
He was on attack at all times and made some really great saves, or else this could have been a seven score game versus, you know, the four that it ended up. So I just wanted to shout out the keeper for Chelsea. I thought he was playing very, very well.
Yeah,
I mean under the circumstance.
Yeah, it's a case of the scoreline not really showing the true performance for him. Unlucky to concede four, in my opinion. Made a few good saves.
Yeah, and really, you know, it comes down to in the first half, 13 shots on goal versus zero.
Yeah,
and then at the end of the day, it ended up being 15 shots to one.
Which
shot.
Was the one goal Chelsea scored.
Yeah.
Christopher Nkunku with that one, a player who I've always loved. He was a beast at RB Leipzig. Unfortunately, he went to Chelsea, a club I don't really hold in super high regard, and was injured for most of the beginning of the season. So it would be nice to see him keep banging in goals for Chelsea and staying healthy, really, as we look on to a big summer, too, with the European Championships. He's definitely going to be looking to make a run with France, I would expect. 65th minute, Szoboszlai for Liverpool bangs in the third, another just well-worked goal. Liverpool are, to me, the outright favorites for the championship right now, and maybe you have a word on that. If you're looking at the contenders between Liverpool, Man City, and maybe Arsenal, to me, it's pretty obvious Liverpool are the ones that kind of have that edge at the moment.
Yeah, and fair enough. You know, they have played deserved fixtures, mm-hmm. and I guess, you know, unless something spins at the end of this particular season, I'm not 100% in tune how all this works exactly. Yeah. You know, are we talking about some kind of playoff scenario?
No, no playoffs. So it's just pure points. Like, imagine do you remember, well, I say it like I remember, but I'm asking you because you're alive. Do you remember, like, the old Winston Cup in NASCAR, like the point standings?
Yeah, it was guy on the high end wins.
Yeah, it's just that, basically. You know, in NASCAR, it was, if you had the most points at the end of the season, that was it. There was no playoffs, and that is what we're looking at here. Liverpool and Arsenal play Sunday, so I think we're definitely going to look into, well, obviously we're going to look into it, but like, I think we're going to know more about these two teams once they meet again. And honestly, I expect Liverpool to win that and keep it rolling for this season in the title race. And again, let's factor in Jurgen Klopp leaving. That maybe a strategically timed announcement there for him, a good rally the troops type ordeal here, where,
yeah,
you know, if they know this is his last campaign, they're going to try and win everything they can before he goes.
Well, he seemed pretty happy.
Yeah, he was quite happy. How could you not be happy? 4-1 winners here. Quick look at the table before we head out. Again, Man City have played one less match, so it's I would say, a little flattering to Liverpool at the moment, who sit in first, 22 matches played on 51 points. Man City, 46 points, and then Arsenal also on 46 points. Tottenham still sniffing around, 22 matches played, 43 points, and then Aston Villa, 43 points. So it's all tight up at top and the bottom, actually, because Luton Town continue to play well, and they've actually overtaken Everton into 17th. That pushes Everton into the relegation zone. A reminder, the bottom three teams at the end of the year will be sent down to the championship. So obviously you don't want to be in that bottom three. So there is definitely action to pay attention to on both sides of the table. Like I said, Sunday, that's going to be a big one, Arsenal and Liverpool. So we will be all over that for sure looking ahead.
Okay. All right. So I guess, that brings us to a close on this bonus hour edition of Tackling the Chicane. So if you are quite ready, we shall get gone.
I am ready. No real other things of value to say other than, I guess this isn't even really that timely because the Super Bowl is next week, but let's go 49ers.
Well, I have no dog in that fight. My Lions are gone, so.
I know. I really wanted. I was kind of hoping for. Did they blow it or what? As a little tangent here.
Yeah.
Not great. 24-7, and gonna opt to blow that lead. So.
Oh, painful well. To watch.
Yeah. Well, I think that's all she wrote.
Four executive producers: Richard Tanaka, Adam Walls, Greg Killenbeck, this has been Tackling the Chicane for the F1 Factor team, Jimmy Hill, Gavin Ritter, Bob Ritter and Brett Hogel. Copyright 2023. We'll see you next time.